Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. I was a little surprised to learn that there's about 43,000 units of blood are used each day by the United States and Canadian healthcare system. And our guests today are going to help us understand how that blood is obtained and processed and used. So joining me are Kurt Buchholz, a physician and pathologist at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation and its Central Peninsula Hospital. And he's also a board member of the Blood Bank of Alaska. And also with us is Bob Scanlon, who is the chief executive officer of the Blood Bank of Alaska. Welcome to both of you. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
I don't believe we've done a program. I've been doing this about 10 years, and I'm trying to think if we've ever done a program on the Blood Bank of Alaska, and I don't think we have. I may be wrong. I'm getting to where I forget some of these things. Mm-hmm. I also need to mention just briefly that the Blood Bank of Alaska is a nonprofit contributor to KSKA programming. For those of you who are listening, if you've got questions or comments during the next hour or so, you can reach us at our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And also during the next hour, you can email us at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Which one of you want us to tell us a little bit about the Blood Bank of Alaska? Let's bring everybody up to speed here.
Well, I can go ahead and do that, Doctor. Blood Bank of Alaska was founded in 1962. It was in response to, of course, blood needs here in the local and statewide community. In the first year of the organization, collected 682 units of blood with 12 staff members. Now we number a little bit over 100, and we've collected as high as 27,000. Right now we're probably about in the 22,000 to 23,000 units of blood collected. What we try to do at the Blood Bank of Alaska is match demand with collections. We look at the blood that's collected here in Anchorage, Fairbanks, across the state, as a gift from Alaska community members to their fellow community members. So it's very important to us that we maintain faith with those donors, and we couldn't do it without them, and we thank each and every one of our donors.
And you serve the whole state?
We do. We do have a couple of hospitals down in southeast Alaska on the Panhandle, which is served by another organization. But we are responsible for all the hospitals here in the state of Alaska in the event of a disaster or emergency. We also serve all of the military community here in the state, as well as all the Native hospitals.
I didn't think about that. So there's a couple of questions that come from that. I suspect down like Ketchikan and St. Peter's, when you get really down on the peninsula, it's closer to Seattle. Is that the reason for having a different option down there?
Yes. It's logistically a little bit more feasible. They can get let's face it, when blood is needed, it's needed in a pinch, and you need to be able to get it to the hospital as quickly as possible for use by the medical professionals. And if I could also say something, Doctor, and that is we'd like to thank all of the medical professionals across the state who use Blood Bank of Alaska for their blood needs. We wouldn't be able to do it alone. It starts with the donors. We are in that process, but at the end of the day, it's those professionals in the hospitals that are transfusing that blood that really leverage it to its full potential.
Also, I just didn't dawn on me that you're serving the military as well. The military doesn't have their own facility. They depend on you guys 100% for blood products?
And that's a relatively recent change. By recent, when I was in the military in 1982 to 86 in Elmendorf, we were drawing all of our own donors out there at that time. One of the reasons that the military has become dependent upon the blood banks is that a lot of military members, because of their Middle East action, are excluded from being blood donors because of the areas that they are in and the risk of acquiring an infectious disease. So it's eliminated a lot of the military members from donating blood. And so they're dependent upon the civilian community to help in that effort.
And you have more than one facility? There's one facility in Anchorage?
There is one fixed site in Anchorage. We, of course, have our mobile buses that are going out and collecting around not only Anchorage, but in Soldotna, some of the other communities where it's accessible by road. We also have a facility in Fairbanks, and we thank our Fairbanks community members. And then we also fly a lot of crews out to a lot of the other towns and cities throughout Alaska, such as into Barrow and Bethel and some of the other folks. We have very strong support in all of those cities.
And it's my understanding, is like everything else, you're growing and having some growing pains now.
Oh, most definitely, most definitely. Well, you know, we've been in the building since 1981, and as irony would have it, as soon as we got into the building, the FDA decided that they were going to up the requirements in regards to testing, because as you know better than I do, Doctor, that's about the time where HIV came on the scene. That requires a much more strenuous testing protocol. Each one of our units of blood, after it's collected, goes through 13 separate tests to ensure its safety, purity, and potency. I'll let Dr. Buchholz maybe go in a little bit more in regards to what we're doing.
Right. So the first part that starts is the history of the donor. And so there are certain risk factors that if a donor has a history of those items, they might be excluded as a donor. Those could be, you know, have you traveled to an area that has malaria? You know, have you been in an area where there is mad cow disease, like in some areas of Europe? So there's a host of things that are questioned. Each donor goes through an extensive questionnaire and then interview. And then the donor is also examined to make sure that they're physically able to give the blood safely. And then after that, after the blood's collected, the blood is sent off to special laboratories that do additional testing for such things as HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, other viruses like HTLV-1, Western Nile virus, Chagas disease screening. There's a whole host of things that are done to make sure that our blood is safe. And actually, the blood is safer today in terms of being free of infectious disease than it was before the HIV epidemic began in the mid-1980s.
And that kind of brings us full circle back to where we are now with we're seeking a new building.
Yeah.
Right now, we are roughly in about 25,000 square feet of facility. We've been there since 1981. We've had numerous renovations of the building. It's tired. It's ready to retire.
All right.
And so now we're seeking to construct a new building, which as a integral part of the emergency response system will be able to prevail in the event of any type of a disaster. It's being built to hospital specifications as far as redundancy and foundation and security. But it's going to allow us to be able to do things that we're not currently able to do right now, such as we will have a reference lab, which the state of Alaska currently does not have. We also will be able to do our own donor testing, because currently Blood Bank of Alaska, due to a lack of facility, is having to export, for lack of a better term, export those blood samples down out of state. And that creates a lot of issues for us in the event there is a disaster. Airspace, you know, gets closed during those times. And during the last eruption of the volcano, and I can't remember which volcano that was. Do you remember, Dr. Buchholz?
I know Readout was one of them.
Yeah. But we came within 12 hours of not having platelets on the shelf. And we have a lot of patients that depend on us. And, you know, we are working and striving very hard to ensure that we meet the expectations of the owners of the Blood Bank of Alaska, which are the people of the state of Alaska. And that means we need to not only look at what the needs are now, but we need to look at the needs over the course of the next 25 to 50 years.
So you're getting a bigger facility, and when's that going to be available?
Well, we're looking at breaking ground in 2014. Mm-hmm. The facility would be approximately 57,000 square feet. It would have that lab space that we were talking about earlier. It would also allow us to have some additional capabilities that we don't currently have. For instance, we're currently talking our medical officer, Dr. Means, is assisting us in making a determination in regards to starting up a mother's milk bank, which, believe it or not, has a lot of synergies with blood banking. Mm-hmm. A lot of the same demands.
I understand that, but how about the public? What are those synergies that you're talking about?
We have a life-saving mission, and our life-saving mission is to be an intermediary whereby we're collecting a donor's blood, we're processing that blood, we're testing it. We're then distributing it to each of the hospitals where it's used. Mother's milk banking is similar. We have many, many mothers out there who want to share their gift with other mothers who maybe are not quite as fortunate. And so we would be able to be an intermediary to collect that mother's milk, be able to process it and ensure that it's safe, be able to have tracking on it, and then be able to distribute it based on need across the state. So, you know, we already have the logistics in place. We already have wonderful board members like Dr. Buchholz here who are in place to assist us with that. So we have a lot of the infrastructure already set up, which makes sense for us to take that on.
I was thinking about the infectious transmission mm-hmm. risk. Right. I mean, a lot of parents, where I come in or where I'm become aware of the blood bank issue, and I think what we've been using is Denver is where I think they get it, is the neonatal intensive care unit often has babies that are so sick they can't breastfeed, moms can't keep their milk in, or a mother has to have surgery, and then so what do we do? And you get the blood, you get some of this milk from a milk bank, but it's still a human product and has risks of transmission.
Right, and there are about 17 milk banks across the country. None of them are associated with the blood bank, but they do have very specific protocols to protect the mother and the baby, rather, from having milk that might be contaminated. Mm-hmm. So there are procedures, and like I said, it's being done in 17 centers. It's particularly useful for the prematures. Human breast milk is very helpful for their decreasing their morbidity and mortality.
Yeah, it seems like a natural fit. I'm surprised other blood banks aren't doing it, but certainly up here, being as far as we are away, it just makes a lot of intuitive sense. Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners again, we're talking with representatives of the Blood Bank of Alaska. We're talking about what blood banks do and how they're changing. If you've got questions or comments, please don't hesitate to let us get your question. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Once again, 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Before we get too far into the blood banking business and more specifics, there was a caller a minute ago who hung up, but it looked like the question was a simple one from where I stand from, but I think it's a common one, and the person wanted to know how they can know their blood type. I'm going to use that question to lead into why and if you really need to know your blood type anymore. So how do you go find out what your blood type is now?
Well, if you do donate blood, they will type your blood, and they will let you know what that type is. That's one of the ways. Of course, you can also go to any of the hospital labs and ask for your blood to be typed. You might need a physician's order to do that. In general, it's not something that you need to know. You don't, and the reason you don't need to know it is if trauma happens and you need blood emergently, one of two things is going to happen. If you need it so rapidly that they don't have time to type your blood, they will give you emergency release blood, and that will be from usually a universal donor. It'll be O negative blood that they'll give you. If they have time to type your blood and to do a full cross match, then they will do that, and they will not depend on you telling them what your blood type is. They will redo that every time before you receive blood.
And if I may, too, kind of restating what Dr. Buchholz said, we would be more than happy to provide your blood type if you come down to the Blood Bank of Alaska and volunteer to donate. So that's something that we would provide to you for free. We'll put it in writing and send it to you in the mail.
Okay. And Kurt, I have to apologize. I was reading an email that came in. You may have addressed the issue: is do you really need to know your blood type nowadays as much as people think? If you answered that question, I apologize for being spaced out. But
you don't need to know it. It's a nice thing to know. For an example, it's nice for an expectant mom to know if they are Rh negative, because that might involve some additional things during their pregnancy for the protection of the baby. But it's not something that you absolutely have to know.
And if you know your blood type, it doesn't really make any difference anyway. You're still going to get blood typed again if you're going to receive blood,
right?
Because just your blood type's not the whole issue.
Right. And there, what they're trying to do is that they found out, for an example, during when the military initially used to blood type everybody before you went in. This was back in the World War II Korea era. They would actually put blood type on some of their dog tags, and they found out that the blood type was wrong in a significant number of cases. And so generally, all hospitals, it's the standard of care that you will be typed every time before you receive blood, unless in its emergency release.
And the blood typing is really just major blood types. And even though I may be B positive, which I am, I cannot receive all B positive blood because there are other types, other issues related with individual differences besides these major blood types.
That's correct. Actually, we think of one blood system we call the ABO, and then we have the Rh system, which has, that's where we usually Rh positive or Rh negative, but there are many other different components of that system. There's actually over 30 blood bank systems or blood systems, and over 380 different antigens that you could have a reaction to any one of those. So, yes, if you're a B positive and you have an antibody to another unusual antigen like Kel, Kid, or Duffy, they have all these names, the blood could still be incompatible for you.
And so the issue in a bigger sense, and Dr. Buchholz, you correct me if I'm wrong, is this involves the immune system. And so we all have red blood cells, and we have proteins on those red blood cells we'll call antigens. They're just specific antigens or proteins to your body. And our immune system loves our own body for the most part, doesn't like other people's bodies.
Right.
So if they get wind of somebody else's blood type, well, it's not just ABO, but Cal and all these others, and these little proteins, our own immune system says, this is not right. And it gins up an immune response and can cause a reaction. So knowing your blood type is just a small part of whether a blood transfusion is going to be safe for you.
Right, exactly. And generally what happens is that if you react to somebody else's blood, you might have a fever. But generally those antibodies that we produce will attack the antigens on someone else's red cells and usually destroys those red cells. And so what we get is what's called a hemolytic reaction, where you're breaking down the blood that was given to help you. So part of the whole process is to make sure that somebody does not have antibodies to those antigens. And that happens before you receive blood. Your blood is typed and your Rh is checked. And then the hospitals also check to make sure you don't have antibodies to those antigens that you could react to. So that's another part of the testing that occurs. And the Blood Bank of Alaska also checks some of the units of blood to look for blood units that are negative for some of those antigens you might react to. So if a hospital finds that you have an antibody to, let's say, we'll call it an antigen, it's called Kel. They call the Blood Bank of Alaska and say, we need some Kel negative units of A positive, and the blood bank will be able to provide those special units.
So if I sit down and think about this for just a second, you got to have a lot of different kind of blood. You're not just looking for A and B and O, and you've got to have a lot of other blood around. And so it requires some testing, is what you were talking about earlier.
Yes.
And blood doesn't sit on the shelf forever and last forever.
No. Blood is only, the red blood cells can only be kept for 42 days. And that's from the time it's drawn to the time it's given to the recipient of the blood. Platelets are only good for about 7 days. And the we do freeze some components that help your blood with clotting. It's called a fresh frozen plasma or cryoprecipitate. Those materials are generally good for a year, but they're very deeply frozen. But 5 years?
5 days.
Five days, yeah. The frozen component, so it can be kept for a year.
For a year. Yep. But our platelets, FDA did change the requirements, and now platelets are good for 5 days. So they've closed that window on us.
And platelets are small components of the bloodstream that help us do a lot. We're learning more and more about platelets as we're learning about everything. But basically, we think of them as helping us seal off that cut and stop bleeding, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a component that sometimes is used because people, just like they can have low numbers of red blood cells, they can have low numbers of platelets, and that's not so good if you start bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the components. What other components, since we're on this component issue? We've talked about factors that help us clot, like some of the plasma mm-hmm. factors and the platelets and red blood cells. What else are we harvesting and using nowadays?
The red cells, we produce a special product called leukocyte reduced. So we take the leukocytes that are with the red cells and decrease the number. And the importance of that is that decreases the reaction that sometimes people have to the red blood cells. So we're producing, I think, all our red cells now is leukocyte reduced.
Yes, correct.
The platelets, the majority of those that we're producing, I think, now we're with platelet-pheresis.
Correct.
Which is a special instrument that you get hooked up to, and the blood essentially is spun and separated, and the platelets are taken off, and the rest of the blood is returned back to the donor. So it takes off very special amounts of platelets, and that's called platelet-pheresis product. And one of those products is equivalent to, I believe, 6 to 8 regular. If you took a unit of platelets and just separated off the of red cells and separated off the platelets, you'd get with the platelet-pheresis, you'd get the equivalent of about 6 to 8 donations on that. And those are also specially tested, so they're not contaminated with bacteria, which is a new thing that's happened. And the other two main products are the fresh frozen plasma and the cryoprecipitate, and those are used for bleeding conditions and to usually treat specific problems that you're having with proteins in your blood.
I'm sitting here looking at notes that I have here. It also mentions, you know, we've talked about some of the things that you're processing, but you've got a recruitment issue, you've got a collection issue, and then we've talked a little bit, maybe not much, about distribution. So there's a lot that has to happen, and there's a limited amount of time that you can have this. So this seems like it's almost like working for a nonprofit. You're constantly trying to make sure you got some money to run things here. This is time critical, and I would see pretty stressful at times.
It definitely is because we're a 24/7 operation.
Yeah.
We have to have the blood on the shelf. And
right.
You know, when I go out across town and across the state and meet with groups of folks, I mean, one of the first questions I ask them is, when you got up this morning, how many of you were concerned whether or not there'd be a unit of blood on the shelf for
right.
you? And quite frankly, nobody ever says, "Yeah, I was worried about it." But
sure.
that points to the success for Blood Bank of Alaska. For 51 years, we've been keeping faith with the people of the state of Alaska, thanks to our donors, dedicated staff at BBA, and, of course, all the wonderful medical professionals across the state. So it can be stressful at times, especially over the course of upcoming holidays, such as the 4th, because those tend to be fairly heavy use holidays. So, you know, again, if I could use your show here just to go ahead and put out a request to the community at large. I mean, you know, if you're interested in donating a unit of blood, please feel free to call the Blood Bank of Alaska. We would be more than happy to discuss it with you.
Who can be a donor?
Well, roughly 37% of the population in the United States are able to be donors. Here in the state of Alaska, we have probably about 4 or 5% of the folks for across the state who are actually blood donors. Roughly anywhere from 48 to 50% of our donors our repeat donors, the and then we have the once a year donor, or the once in a lifetime donor. All of them are important. All of them fill a role in our quest to ensure that there's blood on the shelf, and every single one of those donations saves lives. And as a matter of fact, every donation has the potential of saving three lives.
How old do you have to be?
I think you can start if with parent consent, you can give if you're 16 and 17. Uh-huh. And actually, there are some high school blood drives that I think they're fairly successful with getting parents to consent, and that's a very popular event, actually, in some of the schools sometimes. So, upper limit depends on your health, I think. Mm-hmm. They used to have 65, but I think they've stopped that now, right? It's pretty open to any age range. There's certain health conditions, that when they go through the interview, they'll try to identify certain things that might be a risk for you. They'll also eliminate certain, if you're on certain medications, that could have a negative effect upon the blood or upon you.
Can you go to you have a website, Blood Bank of Alaska. Can they go to that and look and see if they would qualify without having to come in?
Most definitely.
Okay. That link, by the way, is on our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can get the immediate link to the blood bank. I've also put in one of their promotional videos and also just a little bit of information about the history of blood banking, since I'm in the medical profession and very interested in some of the history of various things we talk about. So I thought those were good links for those of you who might want to go that. Again, alaskapublic.org. Look for the Line 1 button, and you should see today's program. And while I'm thinking about it, I should also mention that at any time you can go to alaskapublic.org, hit Line 1 link, and you can see our archive and listen to this program again later or any program we've had. We're going to take a short break, which we usually do, and I want to remind everybody you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number again is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll continue our conversation about the services of the Blood Bank of Alaska. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA, originating from Anchorage, Alaska. And I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Dr. Kurt Buchholz. He's a pathologist involved with Central Peninsula Hospital and the YK Health System, and also on the board of directors of the Blood Bank of Alaska, and also the Blood Bank of Alaska's chief executive officer, Bob Scanlon, is in the office with me. And we're discussing the services of the Blood Bank of Alaska. And if you've got questions or comments, you can email me during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And in the past, we've rebroadcast this program between 7 and 8 each evening. We are now changing that to 9 to 10 each evening. And I want to remind you, if those are not convenient, if that's not a convenient time, you can also go to alaskapublic.org and listen to this broadcast or any previous broadcasts that have been archived at your convenience. Bob, you mentioned that about 37% of the population can meet the criteria to be a blood donor. So I'm going to say, let's say that's 1 in 3. And then if I heard you right, about 5 to 6% are regular. That means there's a significant proportion of us out there that are not using this, are not donating as often as we might want to do that.
And that most definitely. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why. I mean, let's face it, everyone is busy. This is very purposeful, though. To make the decision to donate is a very purposeful decision. And I again want to just express my thanks to our dedicated donors out there. I mean, they make time to get in their car. They come down to the center or onto a mobile bus. They roll up their sleeve and they donate their blood. And they do it with a smile. And they, generally speaking, they come back. And you know, but they have either used the blood, they have had somebody in their family that's used the blood. Or they are just very philanthropic and want to ensure the betterment of their community. And again, the donation of blood is something very, very personal, and it is a gift. It is a gift of life that each one of us as Alaskans have the ability, you know, if we're eligible to donate, but we have the ability to donate that gift. And, you know, if you're not able to donate, again, we are a 501c3 charity organization. I'll put a plug in. We also take financial contributions as well to keep our organization running. So if you feel we are, an organization that you want to support, please feel free.
Okay. We have a caller. Actually, we've got a couple of callers. Noelle, you're on the line. What can we do for you?
Hi. I have a question about donors, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with hemochromatosis?
Yep.
And so I have this condition or disorder, and
right.
So do other family members. And okay. I was just curious, in the state of Alaska, we aren't allowed to donate our blood. Ah. They call it therapeutic phlebotomy. Okay. So we have to pay to get our blood taken, and then they dispose
yeah.
of it.
But Yeah.
In the state of California, the state of Washington, it's fine at the blood banks there.
Huh.
You can donate your blood, and they take it, and they use it.
Okay.
So I was just curious.
What's the deal?
Yeah, what's up with that?
Okay. I'm going to quickly say hemochromatosis is a situation where there's an overproduction of red blood cells, which sounds good until you realize your blood can get so thick it's like oil and doesn't flow, and that's an oversimplification. There's a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. So how come they can't use their blood for donation in Alaska and they can in other states?
It depends on the interpretation partially of the FDA regulations on that, and I was practicing in South Dakota when the change came, and they encouraged that people who give blood for therapeutic phlebotomies, which is a therapeutic phlebotomy is when you donate the blood or you have blood drawn off for your help, your own health as a donor. And we used to routinely take that blood, but the FDA recommended that not being done. I know that's not a real tight regulation, but I think a lot of places discontinued using the blood from hemochromatosis. And I know that can be argued both ways, but I think that's the decision in this particular area. Hemochromatosis is a condition where people store extra iron, and they do produce excessive amounts of blood, and the therapeutic phlebotomy does help them. But that's I think that's an individual local medical director decision based on the FDA guidelines. And the risk is that there are conditions. There's a cancer condition called polycythemia vera, where people will produce extra blood. And I think the FDA was concerned that if we and they also get therapeutic phlebotomies. And I think the concern was, making sure that somebody who has the polycythemia, which is a form of cancer, doesn't get mixed in with the hemochromatosis blood. And I think that's why the FDA made that ruling and recommendation.
So, yes.
Well, it's unfortunate because when I first was diagnosed and had to go I went once a week for 4 months, and I have A positive blood, so it would have been really beneficial. But I still love what you guys do, and that's great. Yeah. But it's unfortunate you can't use our blood.
So it seems like at this point it's a policy decision more than anything, Noel, and maybe it'll change. I don't know.
Well, and
I just wanted to bring it to awareness.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I did not know that either.
Well, and if I may say, ma'am, I would like to thank you for your past donations. Thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
All right, let's take another caller. This is an anonymous caller from Palmer. What can we do for you?
Hello, how are you doing this afternoon?
Excellent.
Good. Let me turn this thing off speakerphone. And now I can hear you better. I appreciate all you do for us in this state of Alaska and worldwide on your hard work of asking people for their blood. It's not an easy thing to do, and some people tend to push that to the back of their minds and not really think about it. So I'm very glad you guys are out there fighting for us.
Thank you.
You did answer one of my questions earlier on whether or not we had to know our blood type. And I have another question. On occasion, I do partake of a herbal smoke, I guess you'd say. Will that affect the fact that I can donate or not?
So do potential, there's the medical use of products like marijuana and other drugs in any way keep people from being able to donate, I think is the question.
Yes.
I won't comment on the marijuana issue because I really don't know what the current list is, but I do know that IV drug usage is definitely would be an elimination from donation.
Well, yeah, but I'm not talking about that. Yeah.
Right,
nasty.
Right.
So we're not. You're not entirely sure.
I'm not entirely sure. I don't know if it's on the donor question. I don't.
I'm sorry to say it's been a few years since I've donated, but right. I've passed your wagons many times and thought about it, but I didn't want to pollute anybody. So
it appears to us that at this point we don't think it is, but I would strongly recommend perhaps getting on the website or making an anonymous call to the blood bank to ask them again about some specific information.
And also some of those decisions are up to the discretion of the medical director of the blood bank.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he would make those decisions, and I haven't personally had an interview with him to know how he would react to that particular question.
Well, I would think considering the way the nation's going towards this product, and Alaska's always been so liberal, I've never heard any stink about it, but I just didn't want to have a guilty conscience of hurting somebody, you know? I appreciate what input you've given me, and I'll delve into it a little deeper.
Well,
good
and
luck
ma'am,
with your drive.
Well,
all
ma'am,
right,
ma'am, feel free to call the Blood Bank of Alaska and ask for our chief medical officer, and feel free to ask him that kind of a question, and he'll be able to advise you accordingly.
What about the issue of other medications? I'm thinking about people who might be under cancer chemotherapy, for example. Are those are contraindications as well?
Well, usually a patient has a history of cancer would be excluded.
Uh-huh.
There are certain medications that are known to cause birth defects. Mm-hmm. Those medications are excluded.
Okay.
Some of the acne medicine mm-hmm. has been excluded because of those effects. So there's a pretty, they do ask you what medications you're on, and they do have a reference guide that says yes or no for certain medications, and they're all investigated to according to the recommendations of the standards.
This is an email that came in, and this gets into a little bit of a sticky question. It may again be an individual medical director decision, but the author of the email says, I've donated lots of blood to the Blood Bank of Alaska and would like to continue. However, I can no longer do that. I have been able to travel to other locations and donate blood. The reason for this is my wife has hepatitis C. And the local blood bank of Alaska seems to interpret, and he gives me a looks like a law that says this is a lifetime ban. It is his understanding hepatitis C is hardly ever transmissible by casual contact or sexual contact. So why is he being excluded?
Both hepatitis B and hepatitis C are transmissible by sexual contact, and that's probably where that's coming. They also are both transmitted by blood contact and sexual contact. Hepatitis A is transmitted usually. That's the one that's frequent in the nurseries, where it's, you know, diapers to hands to mouth kind of contact. So hepatitis A is not as a concern. But hepatitis B and C are both considered blood and sexual transmissible.
So even if he tested negative to hepatitis C testing and his wife was positive, I think is what his issue is, he's still being excluded, and that's still a concern.
Because of the history.
Yeah. And there may be a period of time when he may be infected but has not developed a positive test, and that's a window, we call it, so that blood could be transmitted. So that's a better reason maybe for why that may be.
And blood banks tend to be extremely cautious because we don't want to transmit any preventable disease. So we will err on the side of excluding a donor rather than accepting a donor.
Another email is, can a gay man donate blood?
And that is still excluded for the same reason of the risk exposure. And again, you might test negative for any of the transmissible diseases, but the concern is somebody could be in a window, acquire an infection, and the test not yet be positive.
And so, if I may, too, Doctor, the answer to that question is no. And we are guided by FDA guidelines in that regard. That is not a decision that has been put in the hands of Blood Bank of Alaska, as Dr. Buchholz was saying, and it's law.
Yeah.
What types of donations can people make? We've talked about blood, and Dr. Buchholz, you've mentioned some other things. Are there other things besides blood that people can elect to donate specifically?
They can come to the blood bank, and if they're interested in getting involved in a bone marrow transplant, offered that. There's a way that we can put them in contact with the bone marrow centers that collect bone marrow. They can give red cells. They can come in and just give platelets if they want to, so they can be on a apheresis machine. Those are the main products that we collect at this point. Of course, if we get into the milk banking, that'll be another product that people can contribute.
And I started the program by saying that about 43,000 units of blood or pints of blood are used each year. Is that correct? And then approximately how much is used in Alaska each year? Did you say that at the beginning of the program, Bob, or do you know off the top of your head?
43,000
per day, I think.
Yeah.
Per day. Okay.
Wow. 4.5 people. 4.5 million people receive blood every year in the United States. Okay. And I think in Alaska, we collect, over 20,000 units, and most of that is used. The wastage is minimal.
Another question by email is, after a transfusion, how long before the blood in your body is completely on your own again? Or in general, what's the rate does your blood replenish? He's basically trying to say, what's the half-life of your blood is what we would talk about.
The average red cell survives 120 days from the time that it's produced in the body to when your body basically breaks it down and destroys it. So approximately 1% of your red cells are produced every day. And so if you get a unit of blood, some of that blood will be older blood, some will be very fresh blood. So the unit, generally they say, will have an effect for 3 to 4 weeks.
I had a question here about sickle cell disease. I trained at the University of Tennessee, and in the South, there was a lot of sickle cell disease. Mainly because I don't see as much sickle cell disease again. How does the blood bank get involved in that, and what is sickle cell disease?
Well, sickle cell disease, and there's another disease which is more common worldwide in particularly the Mediterranean area and India, thalassemia. both of them have a similar type of problem, although it's a different molecular problem, but they have a problem with their hemoglobins. And the structure of their hemoglobin causes the red cells in sickle cells to become deformed, and then the sickle cells are broken down. And so basically, the body's destroying its own red cells, and they need to be transfused to replace that. And a lot of times the sickle cell crisis occurs when there's periods of low oxygen, and so the person will end up having certain areas of their, from the result of the breakdown of the sickle cells, they'll end up having problems with different areas in their body due to the sickle cell breakdown.
What are the risks? I've heard people in my office ask me, what's the risk of having my blood drawn? What's the risk of donating blood? And I say, I don't know that there's any significant risk. I usually give the answer, it's far more dangerous to drive in here than it is to get your blood drawn, for sure. But the same is true of immunizations in general. But is there any risk to having your blood drawn?
There are some things that can happen during a donation, although the incidence is relatively small. The people that draw the blood are trained professionals. They're called phlebotomists. And they're very skilled at drawing the blood, but things that could happen is that you could get a slight skin infection, and it's no different than any time you have your blood drawn or you get a small cut. You have that potential of an infection, although the skin is sterilized and it's prepped and everything is done to minimize that, and the incidence of that is very low. Occasionally people will end up with a bruise. And again, that's usually minor, but that can happen. The other thing is that somebody could get a small nerve that gets nicked or something like that and have a little pain from that. Those are the major problems, and they're relatively uncommon and usually minor.
I guess I don't know if, again, I was kind of looking at my notes. Fainting, did you talk about?
Yes.
I mean, have to think about all the risks. Fainting. So nothing's without risk, but things are
fainting
unusual.
Does occur.
That's probably the biggest risk.
I worked with a pathologist when I was back in the Air Force. At any time anybody drew blood from him for any reason, he fainted. So we just laid him on the ground before we even tried to draw his blood. And, this was somebody who was very used to being around blood. But, yes, that happens. The other thing is that occasionally people will get slightly nauseated. Again, that's why we recommend generally that people come in well-rested, usually have a meal before they come in so they don't come in on an empty stomach, and that'll usually help minimize that particular problem. And after they donate, we ask that people rest for a bit and we usually have some kind of refreshment there for the donors. We do recommend there is a period of time, particularly the first 24 hours after you donate, that you are at risk to fainting, especially if you get up too fast, because you have lost about a tenth of your blood volume. So if you do something like operate heavy machinery or you fly aircraft, etc., not to do those for a period of time after you donate, just so your body gets adjusted to recollecting the fluids and being fully charged again.
On the other side of the coin, what are we telling people now their risks are if they received a blood transfusion? There's infection, there's reaction rates, and so forth. So what's the other side?
I don't have the exact numbers with me. That's something I probably should have brought. But generally, the risk from developing any infection, if you put hepatitis B, hepatitis C, AIDS, all of those individual risks are less than 1 in 100,000. Our HIV risk now is less than 1 in 1,000,000, and our hepatitis B risk, I think, is 1 in 200,000. Hepatitis C is also in that category. So there's a risk, but it's very small compared to the other issues dealing with risks that you have in life.
Well, I would even go so far as to say that the American blood supply is about as safe as you can get. It's one of the safest in the world, comparable to the European Union.
Yeah.
How often can people give blood? Is there must be a limit of some sort on that?
That's where I got confused with the 5 and 7 days. Platelets you can give once every 7 days with and the with apheresis instruments is what we have on note here. Red cells once every eight weeks. Mm-hmm. But I think you're limited to 5 times a year, so you have to pick. You got to skip one of those 8 weeks. So you can do that fairly frequently. Now, if you do autologous donation, you're able to give more frequently. Now, autologous we haven't talked about, but that's where you would come in and donate blood for yourself. So let's just say that you were going to have a surgery that your doctor is telling you, you know, it's very likely that we're going to need 2 or 3 units of blood. Would you like to give blood for yourself? So you can go in and give the blood for yourself. The blood bank will keep it labeled for you and set aside for you. Send it to your hospital that you're going to have your surgery. And then when you had your surgery, they would give you that blood first. If they needed more than what you had donated, you'd get the blood right out of the regular blood, if you want to say. But otherwise, that blood, you're getting back your own blood. And that's probably the safest blood product because it's pretty hard to catch an infection from yourself because you've already been exposed to it.
Right. I hadn't thought about that. So there's obviously limits. You'd have to know ahead of time that you're going to be willing to do that. And how much did you say you could take a couple of units? Or?
Yeah, you can do it. You can do it more frequently. Uh-huh. So every 2 to 3 weeks, they have to check where your hemoglobin level is. Uh-huh. And in fact, sometimes there's even a program where if they take a lot, and the blood is getting older, but your surgery gets delayed, they can reinfuse it and then take a fresh unit.
I would like to point out, though, that that's very rare now in Alaska. We typically don't do that. Our blood supply is so safe that it doesn't make sense in a lot of protocols, especially when the physician is concerned with anemia of the patient. So typically, the folks who are going to need the blood, they'll draw it out of the general inventory. There's a lot of logistics involved with the autologous for the patient.
It's like many things, it sounds simpler and more reasonable until you really get down to it.
Yes.
It does raise the question, and this may be way off the wall, is the Jehovah's Witness who does not want to take blood products, will they take their own blood back?
No. My understanding is that, no. Once it's discontinued from the body, then it's my understanding that's a rule that some of them will use.
Comes up sometimes. Yeah. Interesting. It's hard to listen to the radio or the TV or internet or whatever and not hear the word stem cells every once in a while. We haven't talked about stem cells. Is the blood bank involved, or do they anticipate being involved in any way in using stem cells?
We are involved and have been involved. Biggest struggle that we have is making sure that we are in compliance with the FDA regulations on this process, and we've spent a lot of time getting ourselves to the position that we feel we're comfortable that we're complying with all the specific guidelines. And basically, there are many uses for stem cells that are being investigated and developed. And the one program that we've been involved with has been collecting stem cells and being used by the orthopedic surgeons to re-infuse those stem cells into joints to prevent or to repair degenerative arthritis that can occur, particularly in the knee is the area that they're studying right now. And there's evidence that it does help the body regenerate cartilage to repair the knee, the investigations are still ongoing on this, but we are helping to provide that product so that those investigations can be done.
And if I may add a clarification to that, our program is technically cellular therapy, and we are using adult cells. So we are actually taking the patient's cells and processing those, and as Dr. Buchholz said, reinfusing them.
Got a couple minutes left, and I'm so much into making sure our listeners get good health information. And I, for a while, have been thinking about doing a program on the inappropriate use of stem cells. That I need to make a comment that you cannot help but get on the internet if you're sick and see somebody wanting to give you stem cell therapy for problems that are mostly not FDA approved, and they want lots of money for that. And you want to be very, very careful when you see recommendations for stem cells for problems that there really is very little evidence of safety and efficacy. So it's not that stem cells aren't important. It's just when and where are they appropriately used. So a heads up on the stem cell issue from my point of view. We just got a couple minutes. Are we currently having any shortages we need to know about? Anything we can help you with?
Well, currently we're preparing for the 4th of July holiday. Our inventory now could use some B donors, B positive donors, and some O negative donors. If you're a B pos, a known B pos, or an O neg, or if you want to just come down and donate, please feel free to come on down to Blood Bank of Alaska. We're down on Laurel Street, 4000 Laurel, and we would be happy to take your donation.
Got your phone number on the top of your head?
I do. It is 222-5600. And I'm being told here 5630. 222-5630. Okay. If you call the 222-5600, that'll put you in touch with the switchboard. So either number will work, but specifically the last number will give you to the recruiters.
All right. Any last comments? Anything else you want to make sure we say?
Just to emphasize the fact that we do see lives that are saved because we have blood available. And we're able to save lives out as far as, you know, in the rural areas like Bethel, even from the villages surrounding Bethel, down on the peninsula, because the Blood Bank of Alaska provides us that blood, and we can infuse it, and they will respond emergently to get us blood to save lives.
And if I may add, we currently have a capital campaign going on for the construction of our new building. If any of your listeners would like to donate to that to this project, please feel free to give us a call down at the Blood Bank. Again, 222-5600. That'll put you in touch with the switchboard. And then please talk to our development director, Rebecca Parker, and she'll be able to assist you. Oh, and online, you can also donate online at bbak.bloodbankofalaska.org.
Mm-hmm. And you can also get that link at alaskapublic.org on the Line 1 studio program as well. All right. Listen, I want to say thanks very much. It's been educational for me, and I'm sure some of our listeners have learned, and hopefully we can get some people out there to help you get your blood bank ready, and hopefully it won't be used for July 4th. My thanks to today's guest from the Blood Bank of Alaska, Dr. Kurt Buchholz. He's, as I said, a pathologist involved with the Central Peninsula Hospital and Yukon Kuskokwim Corporation, and Bob Scanlon, the CEO of Blood Bank of Alaska. If you want to continue this conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at Alaska at Line 1 at alaskapublic.org. I'm sorry. Next week, our guest is the host and producer of the popular Brain Science podcast, Dr. Ginger Campbell. We'll be discussing the most important recent advances in understanding how the brain works. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, July 8th from 2 to 3 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA. And please remember, you can listen at any time by going to kska.org and finding the Line 1 link to our archives. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our engineer today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.